This week we celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Here to tell us about an event that involved Irish immigrants in New York City over 100 years ago is Kevin Baker. Some of you may recall Mr. Baker from his previous visit to our show when we discussed his historical novel, Dreamland. His op-ed for us today is based on his essay, The Riot That Remade a City, that appeared in the November 1999 issue of American Heritage magazine.
It's interesting to note, this St. Patrick's Day, how much our nation has in common with the America of the 1840s, the America that hosted the first great wave of immigration from famine-stricken Ireland. The United States of the 1840s was, like the United States of 2000, a confident, prosperous nation riding a wave of breathtaking industrial progress. And like the United States of today, America in the 1840s was a society roiling with change, absorbing new citizens with very different customs, languages, and religions. A society in which millions were left behind in the rush to wealth, one given to terrifying moments of violence and dark conspiracy theories directed against the Masons, the Catholic Church, or the money power. The worst fears about what this new America would be seemed to be realized on May 10, 1849, when New York City was shaken by a riot that would have seemed ludicrous if it had not been so horrifying. The Astor Place riot began as a rivalry between two leading actors of the day, Britain's William C. Macready and America's own Edwin Forrest. Forrest was the darling of New York's predominantly Irish poor and working class. He blamed Macready for orchestrating the failure of his recent tour of England, and when Macready came to the United States, thousands of Forresters, rallied by demagogic politicians, tried to storm New York's Astor Place Opera House. State militiamen fired into the crowd, killing some 31 people. The riot shocked many of New York's leading citizens, including such men as the industrialist Peter Cooper, the journalists Horace Greeley and William Cullen Bryant, and the landscape architects Calvert Vaux and Frederick Law Olmsted. These self-proclaimed reformers were not above many of the prejudices of their time, but more importantly, as historian Ivor Bernstein has written, they shared the conviction that their city and their country teetered on moral catastrophe. They set out, through both the government and the private sector, to actively assimilate America's millions of new immigrants. Not everything they came up with worked, but the legacy they left included such outstanding institutions as Harper's Magazine and Cooper Union, a free college that lies within a few yards of where the dead fell in Astor Place. And then there was the jewel in the crown, New York's Central Park. For its architects, Olmsted and Vaux, the park would be the big artwork of the Republic, an attempt to translate democratic ideas into trees and dirt, a literal common ground where Americans of all backgrounds and classes could go for an experience that would be both uplifting and enjoyable. Today, with its ballpark and its rolling lawns, with world-class museums of art and natural history, and with its free educational programs, Shakespeare productions, concerts, and operas, the park has very much fulfilled this vision. Our problems now seem less daunting than they did to the reformers of the 1840s. Yet we must ask ourselves, what are we doing that comes close to the commitment they made to our nation? What are we building now that will remain a useful and beloved institution of our democracy 150 years into the future?
Today's problems in Northern Ireland date back several centuries. After combing the archives of history, we found one of the earliest opinions on record of the Irish from an English knight, talking about the people he encountered when he accompanied England's King Richard III on his 1394 invasion of Ireland. In a lesson the English should have taken to heart, the knight explains why making war on the Irish was difficult, even then. "Ireland is a land of wild terrain," the knight wrote. "Tall forests, stretches of water, peat bogs, uninhabitable areas. You can't tell how to make war on the Irish, because there are no towns, nobody even to challenge, if that's what they want. They gather in the woods and forests, where they live in trenches dug under the trees or among the bushes, like wild animals. When they hear that you have come to attack them, they gather in several places by different paths, so that you can't get at them. But when they see their chance, they have the advantage in attacking you because they know the country, and they are very skilled. No mounted soldier, however good his horse, can ride fast enough to stop them catching him. They spring from the ground onto the horse, put their arms around the rider from behind, and pull him down. Or they stay up on the horse and grip him so tight that he can't defend himself. They use sharp knives with a broad double-edged blade, like a spearhead, and they never reckon a man dead until they have his throat cut like a sheep, slit his belly, and take his heart out to eat as a delicacy, say some people who know them. They never take prisoners for ransom, and when they see they are coming off worse, they scatter into the woods or into the holes in the ground so you can't tell where they've gone.